As I mentioned, Duke economist William Darity is our guest in this hour. He's back to update us on wealth inequality in the Trump-Biden era. We were just talking about Trump-Biden, Trump and Biden, I should say, or Trump or Biden, for that matter. We're discussing all those things in our prior hour. But this hour, we talk about the money during this Trump-Biden era, specifically the black money, the black wealth. Many of you saw the president's recent State of the Union address, so I'm going to play a clip that you may have already heard. You probably saw it in real time, but take a listen, and then we'll commence our conversation with economist William Darity.
A record 16 million Americans are starting small businesses, and each one is a literal act of hope. With historic job growth and small business growth for black and Hispanics and Asian Americans, 800,000 new manufacturing jobs in America and counting. Where is it written we can't be the manufacturing capital of the world? We are, we will. More people have health insurance today. More people have health insurance today than ever before. The racial wealth gap is as small as it's been in 20 years. Wages keep going up. Inflation keeps coming down. Inflation has dropped from 9% to 3%, the lowest in the world, and tending lower.
Professor Darity, good to have you back on this program. How are you today, sir?
I'm fine, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm sorry I'm contributing to the interruption of Stevie Wonder, but I'm glad to be here.
No. I appreciate you sharing that, and it's okay. It's okay. We all love Steve, and we'll play some more Stevie a little bit later. But for now, I'm excited to have this conversation. And Stevie listens to this program, so he may be tuned in right now, listening to your expert analysis. And so again, we're grateful to have you on the program. So I played that clip a moment ago from the State of the Union address not too long ago, given by our current President Joe Biden. And what I really wanted to get your take on was that last part where he's talking about the numbers as he sees them when it comes to the black wealth gap. Talk to me about what you heard and whether or not the president was accurate in that assessment.
Well, I heard him say that the black-white wealth gap is at the lowest level it has been in 20 years. I'm not sure how he came up with that number. It doesn't seem to be true based upon the most recent data we have from the Federal Reserve Survey of Consumer Finances. So if we were to look at the Survey of Consumer Finances for 2019 and compare with the data from 2022, which is the most up-to-date data that we have available, there was an increase in the gap between black and white net worth from $164,100 in 2019 to $241,120 in 2022. So that would be an increase of about $77,000. And if you were to calculate the gap at the conventional average or the mean per household, it would have increased from $841,900 to more than $1.15 million. Both of those would constitute increases that are significant, even if you took into account inflation. The median increase would have been 21.4% after accounting for inflation, and the mean difference would have been about 16% after accounting for inflation. So, whatever I have to say, positive or negative, about the president, I don't know how he came up with that claim.
I want to interrogate that claim when we come forward. Just getting started in this hour with Duke economist William Darity, and there's a great deal to talk about regarding Joe Biden and black folk, for that matter, Donald Trump and black folk, particularly when it comes to this notion of wealth inequality, what both men have done or not done, what both men propose to do or not do. Who better to talk about these issues with than William Darity? And we'll do that when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
Interrogating and unpacking.
That's what we do around here.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley. Smiley. Who do you trust to get at the truth?
Tavis Smiley.
That's who. The conversation continues right now.
Well, I trust William Darity to help get to the truth as well. And so I'm always honored to have him on this program when it comes to black folk and numbers or just the economy writ large. But today I want to focus on wealth inequality. So let me start by asking this question. I, of course, am not naive, Professor Darity, in asking this. But I'm asking it because you are an economist, you are an African-American economist, and there may be some insights here that I'm just overlooking. Clearly, as Johnny Cochran once famously said, race is a part of everything in America. But why, to your mind as an economist, is this black-white wealth gap so stubborn?
I think the black-white wealth gap is so stubborn because of the nature of the types of policies that our federal government has pursued. In the period, the 160 years or so in the period succeeding the Civil War, beginning with the failure to provide the formerly enslaved with 40-acre land grants that were promised to them as restitution for their years of bondage, while the federal government was providing 1.5 million white families with 160-acre land patents in the Western Territories under the Homestead Act of 1862. And so you had the formerly enslaved getting virtually nothing, and you had a significant segment, probably about 10% of the white American population, receiving substantial land grants in the western part of the United States. You had the period of legal segregation, which was accompanied by a series of upwards of about 100 massacres that were conducted by white terrorists, where not only did they take black lives, but they seized and appropriated black-owned property, which reinforced the wealth disparity between blacks and whites. In the 20th century, the federal government moves away from asset building by land distribution to asset building by supporting home ownership. And it does this in a highly discriminatory fashion in such a way that we had the introduction of the phenomenon of redlining, and then we had the application of the GI Bill, the home buying provisions of the GI Bill, in such a way that it built the white middle class in the United States, but did not do the same for black Americans. And then, on top of that, we have the whole period of so-called urban renewal, as James Baldwin famously called it, Negro removal, mm-hmm. which resulted in the destruction of black neighborhoods and the destruction of black-owned business districts, which, again, resulted in an intensification of this gap in wealth between blacks and whites. So we have a long history in terms of U.S. government policy promoting the acquisition of wealth by whites and denying black Americans the opportunity to do the same.
Let me ask you then the obvious question, given what you've just laid out so brilliantly and so eloquently, whether or not good public policy could turn that tide. Or is racism so strong a factor that even good public policy is no contender for racism?
Well, I think that good public policy that would address the racial wealth gap would do it in a direct way. It would mean a substantial transfer of resources to black American households. And I've put that transfer in my work under the label of a reparations program. Mm-hmm. And the reparations program that would be required to eliminate the racial wealth gap, given the fact that the average black household has $1.15 million less in net worth than the average white household, would essentially be an expenditure of about $16 trillion by the federal government. So the question that has to be asked by people who say there are other policies that would work mm-hmm. is whether or not those other policies would effectively close that $16 trillion gap. And those other policies people typically talk about are indirect measures. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that those indirect measures probably are not going to be sufficiently effective.
This is getting good, as we say around here. This is getting good. Let me follow you as I always do and will for the rest of this hour, because you're saying stuff now that I think we ought to unpack a bit. Let me start with this. Again, here's the word naive. No naivete here. But what would be, just make this case for me, to the extent you can, I believe you can, how would the country, how would the nation benefit by a direct infusion of resources to the black community versus these indirect public policies? Hold on, let me finish my frame here. Whether you call it reparations or anything else, and trust me, I got some reparations questions for you. We'll get to that. We know you as the leading economist in this country who's been tracking this reparations issues vis-a-vis the money. We'll get to that later in this hour. My question right now is, what would it benefit the government? How would it benefit the government? How would it benefit the economy? That's what I'm really getting at. How would it benefit the economy if there were a direct infusion of cash, or whatever you're going to define that infusion as, to Black America, as a way to help shrink the black-white wealth gap? Now, I'm not naive. I know they don't care about this. I'm just trying to ask if there are any economic reasons you can give me, as we make the case, for why they ought to address this issue of the black-white wealth gap directly versus indirectly. We all recall, we were discussing Barack Obama in the last hour with our guest Mark Lamont Hill, and talking about the fact, as we all recall, that Obama was in some way scared of his own shadow. He didn't want to do anything that he could be accused of aiding and abetting directly black people. He even coined the phrase, "I ain't the president of black America." He didn't say ain't. "I'm not the president of black America. I'm the president of all of America." And we bought that line, hook, line, and sinker. He kept putting that line, "I'm the president of all America." And the argument was that I can't do nothing for y'all Negroes directly. But your argument is that these indirect public policies are not having the intended impact, or maybe they are, but they're not moving the line. They're not shrinking this gap between black and white when it comes to wealth. That's a mouthful, but I think you take my question. Is there an argument you can make economically for how direct engagement, direct resources, direct interaction is the appropriate way to go and would benefit the economy versus all these indirect policies? Now shut up.
Let me be frank. There is an argument that can be made. I'm not sure it's valid.
Okay.
But the argument that can be made is that if you engage in any significant expenditure act where you're transferring funds into the hands of potential consumers, you can produce a stimulus effect for the economy, particularly in a period where the economy might be in an economic slowdown. Now, we're not in an economic slowdown at this moment, but a lot of people are forecasting that we might go into such an economic slowdown. I'm not certain that you always have a positive stimulus effect on real production in the economy, as opposed to just simply driving up prices. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to have my claim for the case for reparations for black American descendants of U.S. slavery to hang on this argument that there might be a stimulus benefit for the economy as a whole. I will say this. It will be a situation in which the nation finally addresses its moral obligation mm-hmm. to a segment of the population that has consistently been denied full citizenship. And to the extent that the crippling of that full citizenship has resulted in black Americans not being able to flower in their full range of talents and capabilities, the nation has denied itself elements of black genius that it would otherwise have benefited from.
Hmm. I'm working my way toward that. Trust and believe. We can go to the reparations issue, I promise you. Let me stay with two other issues for the time being, and both have to do with Joe Biden. Before I get to the strong job growth, the economy's had for 39 straight months. We'll get to that and what impact that's had on black people and black wealth. With regard to Joe Biden, we started this hour playing that clip, of course, of his comments at the State of the Black at State of the Union, rather, where he suggested that there had been a decrease in the black-white wealth gap, the lowest ever, and you pushed back on that and said not so much. Have you seen anything that Joe Biden has done politically, anything he's done economically, that aids and abets a decrease in this gap, whether or not he's right about the fact it's the lowest ever?
So I think that the conditions with respect to unemployment in the United States are comparatively good.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think some of that success is linked to his efforts to engage in infrastructure development in the United States. Mm-hmm. So I view all of those things as positives. But let me say this. Even though black Americans are experiencing a much lower rate of unemployment than we typically experience, it still is about two times as high as the white rate. So what our public policies typically do not do is, if they improve absolute conditions, they don't necessarily change the relative position of black Americans in comparison with white Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so you may have a much lower unemployment rate for all Americans and a lower rate for black Americans than normal, but it still remains significantly higher than the white rate. So, this is the problem with American public policies that do not center directly on the needs of black Americans, that they leave the relative position unchanged. And in some cases, like the racial wealth gap, the absolute difference gets larger.
Yeah. I'm thinking as you're talking about a Bible verse, and I'll tell you why in just 2 seconds here. As you were talking, my mind went to that Bible verse that we all know. The poor you will have with you always. I've seen people take that scripture and twist it like a pretzel to mean all kinds of things. I ain't got time to get into the hermeneutics of the text. But that phrase we've heard 1,000 times coming out of the Bible, that the poor ye will have with you always. I thought about that scripture in part because of what you were saying about the fact that we're experiencing, black people that is, experiencing lower employment now than we typically do, but it's still twice that of whites, which leads me to ask whether or not, just as we will always have the poor with us, this gap between black and white and unemployment issues or employment issues will never be 1-to-1, 0-to-0. Just tell me, that's never going to happen.
Well, no, there's actually a straightforward policy that would be beneficial for all Americans that would eliminate unemployment altogether.
Okay.
And so we would have effectively a zero rate of unemployment for all Americans. And that's a federal job guarantee. And I've actually been a longtime advocate of the federal government standing as an employer for all Americans who would seek a public sector job in lieu of work in the private sector.
Tell me more about how that would work. How would that work? Talk to me.
So the federal government, like the activities that it conducted during the Great Depression under the Works Progress Administration and the Civilian Conservation Corps, would stand ready to provide a job for any American who wanted a job and who was unable to find a job of sufficient quality in the private sector. So the federal sector jobs would provide wages that would be above the poverty line and would be inclusive of a benefits package that would be similar to the benefits package that all public civil servants in the United States receive, and that would have as a component medical insurance as well. This would be a program in which the array of jobs that would be made available would fill the kinds of gaps and deficiencies we have in American society today. So we would have physical infrastructure improvement jobs, mm-hmm. including people engaged in employed work for rehabbing schools or building new school structures, people serving as teacher aides in schools. We could also have a variety of human infrastructure activities like child care and elder care professionalized under the rubric of a federal job guarantee. So there's plenty of work to be done, and we could perform that work by guaranteeing employment for everyone. And then that's a situation in which the black and white unemployment rates would be identical because they both be at zero.
I'm hearing, moments ago I was hearing the Bible in my head, and now I'm hearing my grandmother Big Mama in my head. Baby, it's just too much like right. It's just too much like right for an idea like that to get off the ground. Nevertheless, when we come forward, I want to interrogate this idea. My question, as you heard moments ago, was how could we ever, will we ever see black and white unemployment or employment at the same level? I can't imagine it, and leave it to William Darity to say, oh, no, Tavish, there is a way to do that. And the way to do it is called a federal job guarantee. Now I've got more questions about that, and I ain't got to reparations yet. I'm glad I've gotten for the hour. You're listening right now to William Darity, and I'm glad about it on Tavish Smiley.
For all the freedom-loving folk, this is Tavish Smiley.
I feel like free.
Smart talk for curious people just like you. You're listening to Tavish Smiley.
Tavish Smiley and Duke economist William Darity, who is on with us in this hour, talking about this stubborn wealth gap between black and white in this country, and what, if anything, can be done about it. President Biden, in his recent State of the Union address, made the claim that the gap between black and white wealth in this country is at its lowest point ever. And Professor Darity says that's not exactly correct. I appreciate these news sources and news outlets that fact check what these candidates say. And so I've got my own fact checker today named William Darity on this particular issue about the gap between black and white wealth in this country and where it really sits. He unpacked that for us with great detail earlier in this program. If you missed that, check out the podcast of this conversation. When it's posted later, you can hear how he broke that down. I won't ask you to repeat all of that. But suffice it to say that the president was slightly off, according to Professor Darity, in his assessment about the state of the condition of the black-white wealth gap in this country. That said, again, in case you just tuned in, so I asked Professor Darity minutes ago whether or not we are always going to live in a country where there would never be one-to-one or zero-to-zero when it comes to the black-white wealth gap in this country. He said, well, no, there's a way to address this. And the way to address it, according to him, is...
Well, let me clarify.
Clarify for me. Okay, great.
We were talking about the unemployment rate.
Yes,
gap.
The unemployment rate. You're right. Glad you said that.
And closing the unemployment rate gap.
That's right.
Won't have much of an effect on the wealth gap.
That's why you're the economist and the expert, and I'm just a lowly talk show host. He's absolutely correct about that. I said the wealth gap, and we did talk about that, but we specifically, when it comes to this federal job guarantee, we're talking about the unemployment rate. He is correct. I stand corrected that we're talking about the unemployment rate. So now you've got me back on track here. We'll set the wealth gap aside for just a moment. I want to come back expressly and specifically to the unemployment rate that you were talking about regarding this federal job guarantee and the impact it would have on unemployment. So that unemployment would be 0-0 for black and white if we had a federal job guarantee. Am I right about that?
That's correct.
All right. Now, let me move forward then. Now that I got my mind right. It's get your mind right, Negro. Now that my mind is right, let me move forward. So I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you to tell me why the folk in Washington, if they really care about reducing unemployment to zero for everybody, as my grandmother would say, again, this idea is too much like right. It's just too much like right. So I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you to critique your own idea and tell me why the folk in Washington would never take something like a federal job guarantee seriously as a matter of public policy.
Actually, that's a terrific question, especially given the fact that 80% of the U.S. public, even a majority of Republicans, are in favor of a federal job guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have political activity at the congressional level that corresponds to public sentiment.
Mm.
And my theory is it's because if you introduced a federal job guarantee, you would set a floor on the quality of jobs that would have to be offered by the private sector, because they wouldn't get employees at all if they continued to offer poorly paid, unsafe jobs with unpredictable hours of work.
Mm-hmm.
Because folks would reject those jobs and take the public sector job as an alternative. So what you're really doing is you're setting a minimum standard for employment across the entire economy. And I think that there's real nervousness in some sectors of the private economy about being compelled to have to provide quality jobs for everyone. I think that's the political resistance that lies in the background of a policy proposal that the vast majority of Americans endorse.
I knew there had to be an answer to it, and I appreciate the honesty and the transparency in the answer. It makes perfect sense to me now that you've explained it. The private sector will push back on this because it puts them in a trick bag, puts them in a box as they see it. I take your point. So let me interrogate that then. If we have been told perennially that it is, you know, Calvin Coolidge once said, as you know, that the business of America is business. At least that quote was attributed to him. That the business of America is business, said former president, President Calvin Coolidge. And even if we talk about small business, Joe Biden talked about this in the clip that we played at the top of this hour. That small business, many people believe, is the engine that really drives this country. So what impact would it have, not just on corporate America, on these multinationals, but what impact would a federal job guarantee have on small business in this country?
Well, it depends upon whether the small business's business plan is based on paying low wages or not.
Uh-huh.
So if their business plan is predicated on paying low wages to their employees, then yeah, they'll be damaged by a proposal of this type. But the idea here is not to eliminate the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
It's to use the public sector as a mechanism for improving the performance of the private sector. So essentially what we want with a federal job guarantee is to have the public sector function as a competitor, a competitive employer with the private sector.
Mm-hmm. They ain't trying to hear that, Professor Darity. They got enough competition as it is. Let me back up. I was just on this program the other day saying, just expressing my viewpoint of how sick and tired I am of these monopolies. More and more we live in a country that's just so monopolistic. I digress on that for now, but that troubles me in a variety of ways. But I can't imagine that the private sector, to your earlier point, would welcome increased competition from the federal government.
And that's probably all the more reason why it needs to be done.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. I like that response. I suggested earlier, the data on this, in this regard at least, seems incontrovertible, that for 39 straight months the economy has grown. I'll come in a moment to why you think whatever you think of Joe Biden. I want to ask you why you think Joe Biden isn't getting credit for this. But the numbers suggest to us, numbers just out a few days ago, that the economy, the job growth, the economy has grown for 39 straight months. That's a nice track record, 39 straight months. And yet Joe Biden is not getting credit for what he's doing on his particular watch. I want to ask Professor Darity why he thinks that's the case. But my real question is, are black folk benefiting in any meaningful way from these 39 straight months of job growth in this country. And then, of course, we'll talk a bit about reparations. Again, no economist in the country is doing more work tracking reparations by the numbers than William Darity. So we'll do all that when we come forward in a moment.
From the Merck Park with love, this is Tavis Smiley. Let's get back to more of Tavis Smiley right now.
More of William Darity right now, Duke economist, joining us in this hour to talk about black folk and numbers, specifically wealth inequality and unemployment numbers. So the first question, why do you think President Biden, on the campaign trail at least, is not getting the credit for these 39 straight months of increased and strong job growth, Professor Darity?
It may be because of the effectiveness of the propaganda of his opposition. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that there's any other reasonable explanation. Presidents generally are not actually responsible frequently for the actual performance of the economy, but they normally get credit for bad times, mm-hmm. if they occur while they're president, and they normally get credit for good times if they occur while they're president. And so I suspect that the reason why Biden is not getting credit for relatively prosperous times is because the propaganda machine that's poised against him is very, very effective.
No, I receive that. Let me ask you this question. I want to spend a few moments talking just about reparations. But since we're talking about Biden, let me ask you this question, and I hope it's not too uncomfortable, and you can frame it and respond any way you want. But when it comes to the issue of reparations, how does that impact the way William Darity, given that you spent, you know, much of your life working on this, how does the issue of reparations impact the way you engage, the way you see the political process, specifically with regard to how you cast your vote? And I'm not asking who you're voting for. I'm just asking what the connection is between this issue, reparations, and how William Darity does, in fact, cast his vote.
Well, the attitude of political candidates towards reparations certainly is a key factor in my decision about who I personally mm-hmm. choose to support. Mm-hmm. I will say this, the people overestimate the degree of opposition to reparations in the United States. Mm-hmm. They'll frequently say, you know, it's a very small percentage of Americans who endorse reparations. Well, it's certainly a minority, but it's no longer a small percentage. Mm-hmm. In the year 2000, a survey that was conducted by Michael Dawson and Ravana Popoff at the University of Chicago found that 4% of white Americans endorsed monetary reparations for black Americans. Today, that figure is closer to 30%, mm-hmm. according to a survey that's been conducted at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And I think that if 30% of white Americans now are in favor of monetary payments as reparations, that's a significant foundation for building the level of political support that would be needed to get Congress to act in an appropriate way.
I tell you what,
but we do have to think about the expressed opinions and attitudes that our candidates have about the reparations question.
Nope, I receive that. When we come forward in our remaining moments with Professor Darity, I want to ask him this question, which occurs to me right now. Perhaps it occurred to you as well. I'm trying to juxtapose these numbers or these two realities. The data that Professor Darity just quoted suggests that from 2000 to 2024, the number of white people who believe in cash payments for reparations, reparations as cash payments, has gone from 2% to 4%, rather, 4% to almost 30%. And did you say 2 or 4, Professor Darity, 20 years?
I said 4%.
You said, I thought
2000.
That's what I thought. I'm getting my 2s and 4s confused. So 4% in 2000 was the number. In 2024, that number is almost 30%. I'm happy to hear about that growth, But I'm curious as to what he makes of why that number is growing, or how that number is growing at a moment when our politics are so divisive, at a moment when, you take my point, we'll let him respond to it when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
Unapologetically progressive. Progressive. Unapologetically black. 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 You're tapped into Tavis Smiley. Tavis Smiley. Smiley. He's rooting for everybody black. Everybody black. Black. More of Tavis Smiley coming your way right now. Right now. Right now.
Right now. Got about 3 minutes left here. 3 minutes left with William Darity, Duke economist, who I've enjoyed having on this program this hour. I always learn a great deal when he comes through these parts. So help me understand at least how you see these numbers. I'm happy to hear about this growth in these numbers from our from the good white folk, the fellow white citizens, who have moved from 4% in 2000 to almost 30% in 2024 with regard to reparations payments to African Americans. And yet, while I celebrate that, I'm just curious as to how you think that's happened at a moment where we've gotten more and more divisive politically in this country.
I think one of the key factors has been better information, better knowledge about the nation's history on the part of more and more Americans. I think that the reason why we're getting all of this pushback over so-called critical race theory is largely because the segment of the population that is most hostile towards racial equality has recognized that people's attitudes are changing as they become better informed. And so they're trying to quash the process of people having accurate knowledge about America's history.
There was a there's a letter. It made all kind of news a few days ago. ABC News broke it first, as I recall. I don't have it right in front of me. As a matter of fact, let me pull it up right quick. I do have it because I was asked to affix my signature to this letter, and I did. Let me, if I can find it right quick, bear with me. But there's a letter signed by 400 academics. There are scholars. There are all kinds of people. Politicians who signed off on this letter to the president, and the headline of the story, you can find it, here it is. Headline of the story on ABC News website, headline reads, over 400 lawmakers, activists, actors, and more signed letter calling on Biden to support bills on racial equity. There are a number of bills in the House right now that the president could support. And if not, he could certainly use executive order to advance a more robust and aggressive agenda for addressing racial equity in this country. Again, this letter was signed by over 400 people. My signature, in full disclosure, is on this, and that's included in this particular story. Derek Johnson, NAACP, Ben Crump, Al Sharpton, members of Congress, Barbara Lee, Sheila Jackson, Lee, Cori Bush, Jamal Bowman, and others signed off on this letter. My question in the 60 seconds I have left, Professor Darity, is whether or not there is work that you think some damage the president can do right now with executive order as we continue to advance this conversation about reparations.
There's, of course, work that the president can do. There's work that state and local governments can do to advance racial equity. But if we're concerned about the racial wealth gap, only the federal government has the capacity to make the level of direct payments to Black American descendants of U.S. slavery that would eliminate that disparity.
Fair enough. I receive it. I see all the time on this program. I love talking to people who are a whole lot smarter than me, because that's how I get a little smarter every day when I leave this studio. It's been a great program so far. In our first hour, Mark Lamont Hill was our guest. What an amazing conversation. In this second hour, William Darity has empowered us with information. I'm grateful for that. And coming up in our third hour, Breonna Joy Gray. For now, though, Professor Darity, good to have you back on this program again. All the best to you, my friend.
Always. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Breonna Joy Gray, looking forward to this final hour when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.